Talk given Saturday, 8th September, 1973. I have often said the context of the heart of religion is transcendence itself. If we want to understand, correctly understand, what any of the great scriptures are about, we must realize that as the fundamental fact. It is the real starting point, not the end point, from which one can understand the scriptures. Which, of course, puts us into a curious situation. We understand the truth of the scriptures only when we have gone beyond the need of reading and studying the scriptures. Because we have realized this inexpressible transcendent which the scriptures try to convey through expression. This is a point which very, very few people throughout the centuries have ever understood and sufficiently deeply appreciated. So you find volumes and volumes produced by theologians and philosophers and others about truth in the sense of that religious truth which is the realization of transcendence. Now, the question immediately arises, I, the man in the world, being what I am, surely am in a hopeless situation, am I not? Because I have not realized transcendence. This truth, this fulfillment of the religious being which is man, has to be there first before I can understand the scriptures. But not being there, well then, is it going to be impossible to understand the scriptures? No, not at all. It is not going to be impossible. Because at whatever stage we are, whatever condition we are in, there is always some point of contact within ourselves with that transcendent real. Supposing we regard ourselves, each one of us, as a sort of a receiving set. There is at least one point of sensitivity in this receiving set which can be caught and which will enable the whole being suddenly to be lighted up for a moment and respond to that supreme reality. And in that response, this spark within us, which is the spark of enlightenment, of divinity, call it what you will, glows brighter and brighter until full realization comes. If one has cared in the right way for religious truth, this is the point. We have to care for it in the right way. Now this is our personal responsibility. And to care for it in the right way requires great intelligence. Because this caring is not just an emotional upsurge. It is not, or it must not be, the fleeing from sorrow, the reaction against misery and pain, the seeking of consolation, of refuge in that which is transcendent. The idea of seeking a refuge in God or the Dhamma or any such thing is a totally mistaken idea. The Dhamma, the truth of religion, is not a refuge. It is, if you like, a port of destination, which is quite a different thing from refuge. If we flee from anything whatsoever, we will always find ourselves imprisoned by that from which we are trying to flee. Because that from which we are trying to flee is merely the opposite, the ambivalent opposite of what we postulate as the escape from that which torments us or from which we are trying to flee. And the ambivalence is inside us. So both aspects remain present continuously. We never do escape. Escape is the wrong word. On the other hand, if we adopt the so-called positive attitude and attack the problem, then again, we are on the wrong track. Because no violence produces harmony. Violence defeats the realization of transcendence. In fact, anything which belongs to the ambivalent sphere, the either-or sphere, the sphere of duality, love, hate, cruelty, kindness, intelligence, stupidity, all these opposites. These opposites have to be transcended. And the transcending of the opposites is a totally different thing from either fleeing from any one of the opposites or attacking it, overcoming the evil, as we say. Quite a different thing. Consider, transcendence is the totality, the whole thing. There is nothing excluded in it. What is it that I call evil? Only that which, in the limited context of my own consciousness, and of my own little limited environment and life, I dislike, I disapprove of, I find troublesome or painful. But supposing my context grows and grows till it embraces the totality, then what shall I call evil? It is all within me. It is all there. It's part and parcel of my whole being. And in that case, it does not hurt. Neither do I like it, nor do I dislike it. Neither do I approve of it, nor do I disapprove of it. I am that totality. But how is the individual to be the totality apart from being one with totality in awareness, in consciousness? Not as a thought merely. That's no good. It doesn't help. The thought, the idea, is of course a starting point. Because unless you get the idea in the first instance, you will never know anything about it. And you can't work towards it unless you know something about it as a starting point. So now, in awareness, one can realize, one can see intensely that where the totality is concerned, all the opposites which we experience, because we are limited and we postulate, get resolved into a complete harmony. Now, this resolution is the thing that emerges out of us as we live the good life, the holy life, the pure life, the religious life. Use whatever terms you like. Now, this sense of totality, this sense of transcendence is our starting point. If it is there, if the slightest sort of spark of it is there to start with, then whatsoever else we do in the limited context gets related to it. And then we are unlikely to go wrong in the limited context. It is only in my awareness that I separate out this from that. It is only because I am conscious in this clouded, confused, limited way that I choose this against that. But both this and that are part and parcel of the whole world. Take the situation where human relationships are concerned. That man is my enemy, this man is my friend. This is what I, out of my shortness of vision, say. But that man and this man are my fellow men and are men exactly as I am. Now, if I see that, if I truly see it, my attitude towards that man will be free from aversion, towards this man will be free from attachment. It'll be free from bondage to the one I like, it'll be free from bondage to the one I dislike, because both attachment and aversion bring about bondage. This is the point. So that it is only a question of the transformation of the manner in which I am aware of existence which brings about the fulfillment of the religious life. Now, this transformation, of course, needs all that comes under the word, all that is comprised within the phrase religious discipline. Now, of course, immediately everybody says, yes, that's fine. Give us the discipline. It cannot be done. No discipline can be laid upon a living being to bring his life to fruition. You might say, but surely it is like this. If I want to become a fine mathematician, I have a little bit of gift in mathematics. I will go to school, I will take up this, that and the other course, my teachers will teach me, I will do as they tell me, I will get into the university, I'll finally get my doctorate and I shall be master of mathematics. Yes, you will. Or you may say, I'm going to be an engineer and you learn all about engines and so forth. You acquire a know-how, you develop a skill. Perfectly true. But this analogy does not apply in the context of life. your own living life process. This is the point everybody forgets. You can acquire a mechanical skill. This is acquired knowledge, not the release of wisdom. This is an acquired taste, an acquired liking, a preference, because you have some gift along a certain line. This is of the world of mortality, of ambivalence, of conflict, of sorrow and joy and all the rest of it. But this other thing, this life within you coming to fruition, is not of the ambivalent sphere, it's of transcendence. Does this body live and remain alive by virtue of any special technique taught me? Not a bit of it. All that happens inside this living body is something which I don't deal with, apart from being sensible enough to take the right food and drink and have the necessary exercise and rest and so forth. And everything just happens by itself. This mystery of the living process and the emerging into fruition as a human being is a living process of this nature. And this is the religious life. Therefore, the meaning of religious life is something utterly different of the religious discipline, I mean. The meaning of religious discipline is something utterly different from the discipline which is academic or mechanical or whatever it is in the world of affairs. Utterly different in nature, and there is no relationship between them. Now, what is this difference in essence? If I go to school or if I go to the factory or whatever it is and learn a particular know-how, a mechanical skill, I am learning, I say. That is one aspect of learning, in which an imposed discipline is the only available method for producing this result. Well, of course, that is perfectly right in that context. But learning in the context of life does not mean acquiring knowledge or a skill. It means growing from within. And a growing process, a life process, as it takes place in the living now, is not something which you know, which you can see. After the growth, you see it. You have a tree growing. There's a living thing. An acorn has fallen in the garden. And next year you see a little thing creeping up, you see. And if you have your garden for 40 years, what happens at the end of those 40 years? By the time 40 years have passed, an oak tree. You might say, oh, like any other oak tree. Yes, like any other oak tree, only insofar as it is an oak tree. And not a lime tree or something else. Only insofar as it is an oak tree, it is like any other oak tree. But any one oak tree is unique, placed beside every other oak tree. Unique, beautiful, wonderful, living, coming to fruition, to fulfillment. That is what you are like. And it happens with every one of you, with every one of us, in his or her own unique way, which the organism itself cannot see. Does the oak know that it is growing? Does the rose know that it is so beautiful and giving out a marvelous perfume? Does the rose bush know that it has terrible thorns which evoke not very pleasant sentiments from the person who happens to prick his finger? No. This is how it is. Therefore, religious discipline is a learning which is a growing from within. But just as the process of growth needs the right sort of sustenance for it, what is the right sustenance where religious learning is concerned? Here you have certain powers within yourself which are that religious sustenance. Your power of attention, first and foremost. Your capacity for mindfulness. Your real pure passion for it. Your freedom from all selfness as to what you will gain as a result. You'll gain nothing whatsoever. The living of the good life, the pure life, the religious life brings no gain whatsoever. Gain is the wrong word altogether. The coming to fruition is something transcendent. And transcendence keeps no ledger account, profit and loss account. Absolutely none. You have all these powers within you. Every one of us has. And insofar as there is this pure passion for truth, for reality, for letting life come to its fruition without my obstructing it through my pleasure lusts primarily, then the lovely thing happens. Just happens spontaneously, naturally, perfectly by itself. I said, transcendence keeps no ledger account of profit and loss. Why? We are coming now to the central point of the whole thing, the very core of the whole thing. Transcendence keeps no account because transcendence is not that which merely puts things together and takes them apart. Transcendence, use the word God, use anything you like, which represents the supreme reality for you. Transcendence is continuously creative. Now, we don't know the meaning of creativeness. We think we do. We have vague ideas about it. The shadow of the ghost of real creativeness is what we may experience in life. We, as men and women in the world, as we are procreative. Biologically, of course, every living creature has procreative power. We are procreative biologically, and in the case of us humans, we are procreative culturally through our arts and our philosophies and so forth. We say we create a poem, a symphony, a statue, etc. This is a procreative activity. Not a truly creative activity, in the supreme sense of the word, creativeness. Something which the world doesn't really understand yet, or know of. Nevertheless, this is a reflection of that which is true creation. Now, what is the nature of this true creation, this creative activity that goes on? It is a continuous pulsation. That is to say, it goes on constantly. But each pulse is not tied up with the previous pulse. The actual pulsation is discontinuous. But it never ceases. We are getting right into deep waters. I want you to stretch your mental and spiritual muscles to their uttermost to get the feel of this thing. Because this is, as far as I know, the very core of the whole thing. To sense, we can't understand in detail, we'd be gods if we do. To sense this creative pulse and something of the nature of this creative pulse. It is a pulsation of, as expressed throughout the centuries in the secret teachings, really, of all the scriptures, of life-death. Now, I don't think that death is the right word in this context at all. Simply because, as those of you who are present at the summer school heard at the evening lecture, the word death has a feel of a sudden stoppage altogether, an annihilation almost. You remember? The word dying has a different feel to it. It is a process. It is going on. Dying goes on. Just as being, coming to birth, is a process. Now, if you can really get the feel of this, you will see that both being born and dying represent change, continuous change. The coming into being, the appearance, in other words, and then the passing out of that being. But the passing out of that being is not annihilation. Nor is it the continuity of being in any sense whatsoever. This is the very difficult thing that has defeated the theologies of the world for clarity of expression. Every single one of them has failed. And they have failed because they have used this word death, life-death pulse, even in the esoteric teachings. No, look at it this way. This will, I trust, be, all I claim for it is that it is probably less misleading than all the other expressions that have gone before. Look at it as the pulse of life, other life, life, other life. But notice, there is a tremendous contrast between these two aspects. Under life, we have distinct beings, things, objects, and a process of change. When being disappears, I use that word deliberately, disappears, we can't see it, disappears into other life, being has disappeared into non-being. But non-being is just as much as being is. In other words, there is no such thing as annihilation. out of non-being, which of necessity must be one total reality, characterless, unformed, no shape, no size, no process, no time, no space, no substance, nothing involved in it. That is non-being. Think of it. Feel it. More than think of it, feel it. This extraordinary state of non-being, where all our criteria, our knowledge, and everything just fades away. Now you see why I say that you can't think these things out. Because all our knowledge and all our criteria fade away. But you can sense it. In all beings, there is this possibility of sensing. That's how we are constructed. All right, sense this. And now out of this one non-being, we see innumerable beings come into existence. The one non-being precipitates millions of beings. You see why I always object to talking of God in anthropomorphous terms as a being, an entity, who is like this or that or the other, which is utter nonsensical talk. It's degrading God down to my petty little level, not even to the level of the really intelligent or holy man, but to my petty little level, the level of the theologian who doesn't know too much, to tell you the truth. You see? All right. Out of this one non-being, the unknown, the unknowable, because all our criteria of knowledge are out. They just don't apply. Space, time, matter, cause, effect, everything disappears into this. And out of that one non-being are precipitated millions of beings, objects, things, situations, events, time, space, everything comes down, so to say, as separate individual realities. And every one of them, in the process of change, disappears back into the non-being. Now look, this creative pulse of life, other life, produces this extraordinary situation. The precipitation into being, the disappearance out of being into non-being. Now we think that this occupies a vast time span. This is another fundamental mistake of which India, I'm afraid, is really guilty. Because it is Indian theology which has presented the concept of the vast process, the divine process, taking hundreds of millions and billions of years and all the rest of it. You know, after all, it's a great pleasure just putting several noughts after any one figure, you know. You just go on making a lovely big duck egg all along the line. Looks grand, you know. I've got £1 only in the bank, in fact, but I put another knot. Ah, that's 10. Put two more knots. Oh, 1,000. Isn't it marvelous? So the whole universe becomes wonderful. God must be a marvelous person. Lives through 100 billion, 5,000 million years and all that kind of stuff, you see. The greatness of God. No. see this as completely devoid of the time process. It is an instantaneous, immeasurable, cannot be measured now. Does any one of us know, in actual, by being actually conscious of the immediate now? We are not. We say, that's what happened a second ago, a year ago, 100 years ago. And the rest is still to come. But this immediate now, the point of eternity, which is also the infinitude of eternity, I don't know. It is the unknown, it is the unknowable, it is the mystery. This is the awesomeness, the majesty of transcendence, of God, of the supreme reality. You see, but the mind of man can be sensitive to it. The heart of man is sensitive to it. Then the mind perhaps formulates or tries to suggest a way of understanding how the heart of love has got hold of the reality. Or has rather, put it this way, has lost itself completely into that supreme reality. So this happens, this pulse of life, other life, takes place in this immeasurable now. Question arises, why is it then that I do experience time? I can't see this pulsation at all. Well, of course I can't. One must have the eyes to see. We have not the eyes to see. The sort of eyes that we have, the sort of sensitivity that we have, the sort of intellect that we have, the sort of consciousness that we have, is so sluggish. We are frightful slow coaches, sluggards of the first order. As I said at yesterday's meeting, we are a little bit like the dinosaurs in this respect. You know, the dear old dinosaurs, they had only a tiny little bit of brain here, and the tip of their tail was a mile off. And if pussycat went and bit that tail, you see, it took about 2.5 weeks before the impulse reached the brain. And then the dinosaur scratched his head and said, "I believe there's a pussycat somewhere. Where is he?" And of course, in the meantime, the pussycat had gone for another dinosaur. 2.5 weeks, he must have gone to a dinosaur about 10 miles away at least. And so there we are. That is the way in which we become aware, with this extraordinary sluggishness. So everything takes on this appearance of time, a great time process. And the movement, which is activity, this pulsation, and the total action which is involved in it, is seen by us as a movement in time through space. Now this, of course, applies to us, constituted as we are, in our physical world. But the mind, which is imprisoned, the soul, the spirit, you use whatever word you like, the intelligence, the buddhi, anything you like, which is imprisoned in this sluggish envelope, has the capacity, in its imprisoned state, to come to the full realization possible to it of disimprisonment. And this disimprisonment can never be reached merely through thinking as a matter of logical philosophizing. You may produce the words. A philosopher can produce these words because he has a brilliant intellect. But it doesn't lead to to this inward realization, by means of which, because of which, he is at one with the transcendent pulsation. That's a different matter. So you see, why? Religious discipline means learning which is growing, which is a coming to fruition, which of necessity cannot be preconceived by us or predetermined by us. Whenever we try to interfere with life, we merely burn our fingers. We must swim with the stream of life. Life in its reality. So religious discipline, which is learning, is this sort of thing. And in this way, this pulse of creation, let me put it this way, we awaken to this pulse of creation. Our inward sensitivity suddenly finds no obstruction in its path. And this innermost sensitivity in us vibrates in harmony with that transcendent pulse. Then you really know the meaning of holiness. You know the meaning of human fulfillment. We know the meaning of the term the Son of Man, as used in the West, the Manasaputra, as used in India. And man, we have gone into this before several times, derived from the Sanskrit man, from which the word mind comes. And it means to think in the sense of to create. This we have stressed again and again in past meetings, you may remember. Manyate, in Sanskrit, to think, is the thinking of Brahman, the ultimate reality, God, use whatever, what word you like. How does God think, like you and I think? Good God, no. Thinking, if when used in conjunction with a term like God or transcendence or the truth or reality, is instantaneous creation. This is thought. This is thought power, mind power, mind power. This creative something. And this is the innermost essential point, reality, fact, use any word you like, concerning transcendence, concerning each one of us. Why have the scriptures of the world presented the God concept as, first and foremost, God the Creator? That's the first thing. God created. God created. Everything else follows afterwards. For God so loved the world that he sent his alone begotten Son. Whatever else is said about God. You can read the Upanishads. You can read anything you like. All the scriptures of the world. All the rest follows from God the Creator. And how does man state that? Let me put it this way. What made man state it? He was only ascribing to this transcendent reality that which he realized within himself. Every description of God is man in apotheosis. That's all. It's not God. God has a twinkle in his eye when he reads. Occasionally, he turns over the pages of our scriptures, just as we read detective novels, for fun. And he says, well, these children, one or two are coming along. But you see, this is the great thing. This creative pulse. I'm devoting the whole of this afternoon just to that matter. Try and let the sense of this creativeness emerge out of you. You can't bring it forth. If you can bring this forth, you can just tell God what to do and He'll do it quite obediently. Let it grow. Life. We are not machines. Life. Let it grow. Don't obstruct it. If you love, if you care, and just remain quiet, it will grow. But if you make a grab for it, the big He-Man style with the beautiful maiden, then you'll get slapped in the face. And may it hurt hard. See? Let it grow. Just remain quiet. So now, have we understood this business of being and non-being? This creative pulse. Now, this is the fundamental meaning of the word karma. We all think of karma as the good old adjusting of accounts, of reward, punishment, an equilibrating system. All those are childish ideas. They are almost putrid ideas. And you know why they are so childish and putrid? Because instead of starting from transcendence, from the other shore where we are not, we want to start from here. But you can't start from here where transcendence is concerned. You can start from where you are, where everything that belongs to the finite and the mortal, the perishable, is concerned. But where the imperishable reality is concerned, you have to start from that imperishable reality itself, which is embodied in you. That's why you can start from there. You don't have to undergo a set discipline in order to arrive at a kind of a worthiness, a certificate, which says, John Smith, let him through. He's all right. He's one of us. Not that. So, all this adjustment process, this reward-punishment process, and so forth, which we ascribe to the word karma, is the wrong way to start to understand karma. Karma, derived from kri, the Sanskrit root kri, means to do, to make, to create. Our word create, our word creation, since English is one of the languages derived from Sanskrit, ultimately, is just this, creation. And where creation is concerned, it is a-causal. There is no causality in it. Because of this, that is the effect. Not at all. Look, how does a great artist create? He gets an inspiration. There is no because involved in it. There is no cause. There is no originating cause. He is like that. Mozart or Beethoven being Mozart or Beethoven, Shakespeare or Goethe being Shakespeare or Goethe, music or poetry just flows out. As a creative stream, you cannot help it. It is so. It is absolute. It is a-causal. It is timeless and spaceless. There is no adjustment made. This is creation. This, at our little level, At the transcendent level, karma, this creative pulse, is completely acausal. It is utterly free. There is no consequence to it. We, conscious in the manner that we are conscious, limited, ignorant, confused, frightened, all the rest of it, you see, we separate out cause and effect. Remember the dinosaur. This was the cause, now this is the effect. No. In actual fact, this life, other life pulsation is of such a nature that the effect is in the cause itself. It's in the instantaneous now. But it's too swift for my poor little perceptions. So I see it as a continuity in time and space. And therefore say, oh, that was the cause and this is the effect. But I fail to see that if I must use the words cause and effect, they are together simultaneously at every infinitesimal point all along the line. Now you just try and feel this out and think this out also in its practical application in life. It is as if you went into a shop, you wanted to buy some object, and the act of that man selling, handing over the goods and your paying are absolutely simultaneous. As I say, we get defeated intellectually trying to picture these things because they are somewhat unpicturable. They are outside our ordinary experience. But if you can get this simultaneity, this sense of the eternal now really functioning, oh, you will find the whole burden of sorrow and misery just fall off altogether. You will find yourself free from this tragic pursuit of pleasure, of security, of success, of happiness, of consolation, of love, of being wanted in the world, and all the rest of this petty nonsense with which mankind is plagued, and tragically plagued. You'll be free of it. But remember, no other person can make you free. Can anyone eat on your behalf, or breathe on your behalf? Can't. Got to do it yourself. But let this sensitivity grow. If my faltering words can sort of bring some sort of answering vibration out of you, the thing will happen. This being, non-being, finite, non-finite, and get the significance of the non-part. The fundamental significance is that none of our standards, our criteria, our modes of knowledge apply to that. And therefore that remains everlastingly the unknown and unknowable by me here as I am. Then you will say, but if that is the case, how can I ever grow into it? How can that be my fruition? It's a very legitimate question. The transformation takes place in your mode of awareness. this limited mode of awareness, tied to the realm of mortality, undergoes this transformation, and then you are no longer conscious, you are no longer a conscious subject being conscious of the other object, the other thing, but you are that of which you are aware, which is a different thing. You don't see out of you. You don't have to make an effort to look within you. The awareness and the being it are simultaneous, and they are one and the same thing. This thing consciousness, discriminative consciousness, vijnana in Buddhistic terms, the real English translation for me at least is discriminative consciousness. This discriminative consciousness is the separator of this and that, of being and non-being, of life and other life. But when this discriminative consciousness undergoes that mysterious change, which it will, then suddenly the whole thing becomes one. And yet, none of the uniqueness of the innumerable many which constitute the one is lost. This is the marvel and the beauty, the wonder of our existence, of our life, and so forth. If you can get even a glimmer of this thing, a sudden flash, your whole life will be lighted up, and you'll never lose that light.